From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. That's when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. And today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin. She's the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun. Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman. And our very own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. Hi, everybody.
Hey, Sam.
Hello, hello.
Hi. Okay, Jimmy, we're going to start with you. I thought this was a little fascinating. You reported on the Donnelly Public Library, which is now smack in the middle of the controversy over Idaho's new library law. So what did Donnelly do? Looks like we lost Jimmy. Okay, jumping ahead. Let's go into our next topic, and Jimmy will come back as soon as we get him. Big primary election on Tuesday. You may have heard about it. But before we get into that, I heard there was a Democratic caucus yesterday. Did anyone know this was happening? Ian, you did because you were there, but not a lot of folks showed up. Where were you yesterday, Ian?
Yeah, so I was at the Idaho Democratic Party's presidential caucus, which, you know, is probably confusing to a lot of people. That we also had another election, as you mentioned, on Tuesday. But at the moment, the presidential caucuses are run by parties in the state, and so they're not run by the state elections offices. And so it was held on a different day, a couple days later. And I think that probably likely contributed to a lot of people not participating. The turnout was something close to less than 2% of Idaho's more than 125,000 Democratic voters. The stat there is a little bit hard to say because unaffiliated voters can also participate in the Democratic Party's caucus. Yep. So, you know, there's a larger portion of people there who also could have voted, but safe to say not a whole lot of Democrats came out to vote. It was a party caucus that was held from 5 to 8 p.m. local time yesterday. There were three locations in Ada County, and then there were a bunch of other locations all around the state. And party volunteers put this together, and it sounds like put in a lot of work to get this done. And I think from talking to party leadership, they're very frustrated that they had to go ahead with the caucus and that the state doesn't have a primary process like in a lot of other elections where you can vote your choice for president when you're also voting for, you know, your choice for legislator for your district and some of the other elections that primary elections that in local races, county races that come up in these elections that we have. And I think so, you know, the Democratic Party, their kind of stance of leadership was that they did the best they could to improve turnout and have a lot of people participate. They allowed absentee ballots, but the turnout wasn't very high. And that's kind of often the case with caucuses. The Republican Party's caucus a couple months ago in March had, I think, about less than 7% turnout. So also not particularly high. And we'll have to see that it's kind of unclear at this point whether in the next presidential election, kind of how the legislature is going to resolve this situation and whether they're going to institute a primary or whether the caucuses or some other arrangement will continue.
Ian, you were, as you mentioned, you were out there. What did you hear from voters? You talked to some folks. You heard about everything from the Israeli-Hamas war to abortion.
Yeah. So what I was curious and hoping to hear from voters was, how they were feeling about the presidential candidates coming up this year in the November election. You know, obviously, President Biden is running for a second term. So he's very much the favorite. He's actually, even before the caucus yesterday, he'd already secured technically enough votes in other states' primary elections to clinch the Democratic nomination at the Democratic National Convention this summer in Chicago. But there were half a dozen other candidates on the ballot that people could vote for. And so I was kind of curious what voters' thoughts were. And what I found was that everybody I talked to, and also I heard some other, you know, voters discussing their votes at Timberline High School was the location I was at. Biden's quite popular amongst the party base. I think a lot of voters are pleased with, Democratic voters are pleased with his administration, his first term. One voter in particular I talked to had kind of a very personal story to tell about her experience with student loan debt, where she works in the nonprofit sector, and so she was eligible for a federal student loan relief program, where essentially if you make payments on time for a decade, you qualify for loan relief at the end of that. But apparently, due to some bureaucratic issues, she'd been making those payments for 13 years and had qualified for it, but it just sort of hadn't been processed. And she said that within a year of Biden coming into office, he instituted some reforms there, and that allowed her to get the student loan relief. And actually, she said it then allowed her the savings there, allowed her to pursue graduate master's degree in public health. And so she was kind of that seemed to be her motivation. She and other voters I talked to also talked about abortion rights and their support for that. I think, in recent months, a few things that have, come up nationally in terms of Biden's popularity. He's generally trailing President Trump, who he's likely to face in November in national polls. And I think there are some concerns among voters about his age. He's 81 years old. He's the oldest president in history. And there are also some concerns about, particularly from kind of the left in his party, about his handling of the war in Gaza, Israel's war in Gaza, which the U.S. has been providing military aid for. And I think I did hear from a couple of voters concerned about the war in Gaza, but I think also maybe a feeling that the presidential nominee, President Trump, would kind of not have an outcome that would be better in their eyes in that war. And I think similarly, the with his age, I think they felt that one voter told me that she felt like if there really were an issue with his age that came up, that his administration would act to remove him from office. There's some mechanisms in the Constitution for removing someone who's not fit to serve at that time. So, and she felt like he has had a lot of energy and passion and appears like a very competent candidate. So, and in the turnout of the results, I should say Biden won more than 95% of the vote of the 2,500 roughly people who participated. So he's definitely a popular candidate for Idaho Democrats.
Let's talk about that turnout. Christina, the Sun reported a whole story on what Ian mentioned. Fewer than 2,500 people showed up for this caucus. That's for the whole state, right? That's everywhere.
Right. And I think this is really something that people should genuinely take notice of. Said another way, that means that 93% of registered Republicans did not participate in their party's presidential primary, while 98% of registered Democrats also didn't participate. And there are reasons that, Ian mentioned that, Trump and Biden are these parties' nominees. We know that by now. There wasn't a lot of motivation for people to come and show up because it wasn't a competitive race within the party. But I just think if this election or future elections are more competitive, if there are real differences between the nominations for either the GOP or the Democrats, and a caucus system is left in place, I think there's going to be a lot more problems, and I think a lot more voters are going to be upset by that because the GOP didn't allow for absentee voting for their primary, their presidential caucus, and so you had to show up between a specific amount of time. Many people have to work; they didn't have childcare. What if you're in the hospital that day? These sort of things are real circumstances that people find themselves in, and so I think for this election, it didn't. Or this caucus, it didn't necessarily matter so much. But I think if there are competitive races in the future, and if the legislature does not find a fix to this, I think it's going to lead to real disenfranchisement of people being able to select their presidential nominee. And we did see in this session that there was an attempt to run a bill that would have addressed this, but it didn't get anywhere and it essentially died when the legislature adjourned. But I think there's many people looking at the legislature to try to find a solution before the next presidential cycle for this issue.
Yeah, and just to add to that, Christina, I think that's a great point. And just for some kind of historical perspective, I look back at 2016, which was the last time the Idaho Democrats caucused, and listeners may remember, that was back when Bernie Sanders was facing Hillary Clinton in what was very much a competitive race for the nomination. And something like 24,000 voters showed up to that caucus. It was more of a standard caucus where people had to be in the room at the same time. I think I read that in some of the old Statesman reporting that it's started 2 hours late because of that.
Right.
So definitely if there's a competitive race in the future, it'll probably be a different environment the day it happens.
Jimmy, let's go back to you. You reported on the Donnelly Public Library this week. What have they done?
Yeah, so starting July 1st, they will become an adults-only library, which will be the first in the state of Idaho, and still trying to get clarification on if it will be kind of the first of its kind in the country as well. So that means that children can go into the library, but they have to be accompanied by a parent, or they have to be enrolled in one of Donnelly Library's paid after-school or summer programs, which obviously limits the availability of that to lower-income families.
Melissa, I want to bring you in. This has a lot to do with size, right? The Donnelly Library just isn't very big.
The Donnelly Library is a very small library. It has a budget of annual budget of less than $100,000. And they have long spoke about their concerns with some of the library proposals and about how under some of the past legislation that just one challenge could have decimated their entire budget for the fiscal year. There are a lot of other very small libraries across the state of Idaho that are just one or two rooms. And the whole point of their concern about this is when you only have one room, it's hard to have an adults only section or an adults only library. The Donnelly Public Library had a lot of after school programs, and they've talked about, you know, continuing those programs for children and trying to figure out ways to do that. But their space is so small that they already constructed like a yurt or large tent outside to have some of those programs. I mean, we're not talking about the Boise Meridian libraries where they have multiple branches. We are talking about very small facilities that serve large communities. And I think that the legislature, when they were talking about these proposals and their concerns about children who were getting their hands on material that might not be age appropriate, they were thinking about the large branches. They were thinking about the large library systems like in Kootenai County or in Idaho Falls. They weren't thinking about the Oakley Public Libraries of the world that are only open 3 days a week and only have one room. And so as we keep seeing how this plays out, I don't know if we're going to see more Donnelly Public Libraries that become adults only, but already there were libraries that were talking about doing very similar things, saying we're not going to allow children to come in unaccompanied and you're going to need an adult to sign up for a library card with you, and you're going to need an adult to come in. And that's going to have a lot of effects on after-school programs if that's how it plays out.
Well, and you know, you're talking a lot about space, but the law says that the libraries can be fined. And if it's something like the Boise Public Library, of course, they don't want to be fined, you know, if there's a problem or you know. But for something like Donnelly that's so small, they don't have any money for something if something, you know, does become an issue.
I think that was a big part of their concern. And the new law that passed, it was damages of, I think, it was a fine, a civil action of $250 plus actual damages, and that's not very well defined. So I'm not sure if Jimmy's back with
Jimmy's
some Donnelly specific. Okay, fantastic. Then I'll let him jump back in. But I imagine that we're going to see similar concerns or other actions from other very tiny libraries across the state.
And we did hear those, you know, during the committee hearings. Lawmakers were warned by plenty of either executive directors themselves or from, you know, the Idaho Library Association and other interest groups representing libraries as well.
And Jimmy, Donnelly is trying to expand their library. And are they using the new law to try and raise cash for an expansion so they could separate books?
I mean, they sure noted it in their statement, basically saying, you know, if you Search your heart, search your mind for a way to help out the situation. Dig into your pocketbook and donate to that expansion, which would triple the size of the library. Right now, it's roughly 1,000 square feet. They can't even really have a lot of their activities indoors because of the occupancy limit and fire code.
And Jimmy, you wrote in the story when you talked to the Donnelly Library director that she compared the new policy to a parent being able to bring their child into a liquor store. The child can't go in without the parent. And that's how it's going to be at the Donnelly Library. That law, by the way, it's taking effect July 1st. So we'll wait and see what happens with other libraries as we get closer to that. Christina, we talked a bit about turnout, voter turnout for folks who showed up at the polls when it was, showed up for the caucus. But you also did a story at The Sun about how many folks showed up for the primary, which was just 2 days before. Tell us about how many folks were there.
Yeah. So turnout was better for the primary election on Tuesday than either of the GOP caucus or the Dems caucus, which happened yesterday. And it was actually pretty average overall for the state of Idaho, all things considered. It's been harder to try to figure out what's average lately, especially with the 2020 election in there with COVID-related things and stuff like that that have affected turnout and how people get their ballots and things like that. But I would stress that it's still remarkably low, especially if you consider that for the GOP primary, for all intents and purposes, is perhaps a more meaningful election in Idaho than perhaps the general election. And with the Idaho legislature being a supermajority Republican legislature since the early 1990s, the GOP primary really matters. But only about 24% of Idaho's registered voters participated in this year's primary. And voter turnout really varied across the state's 44 counties. We saw turnout as low as 16.3% in Nez Perce County in North Idaho, and as high as 55.3% in Camas County in South Central Idaho, which has a very small population. So if people show up, that percentage point can kind of be affected by that. In Ada County, turnout was about 18%, and in Canyon County, turnout was about 20%. So on our website at idahocapitalsun.com, we have maps and tables outlining turnout for each of the 44 counties that people can kind of click around on and see how their county voted. Overall, pretty average, but still very low when you consider that some of these primary elections really do consider the outcome of who's going to win these races and who's going to represent all of us in the legislature and some of these other, we at the Idaho Capital Sun focus on state government, but also for county and sheriff elections and things like that on people's ballots across the state.
Let's dig into the primary a bit more. Ian, you wrote about how the far right faction of the GOP gained quite a bit on Tuesday. How much did they influence this election?
Yeah, so it was a really interesting election result, and I think there was a lot of discussion beforehand about what kinds of candidates Republican voters would be most interested in supporting. As a lot of my colleagues here in the media have reported on, a lot, there was a lot of spending in this election, a lot of money from outside groups running advertisements, attacking incumbents, attacking challengers. I think, from what the outcome showed, I think that the kind of right flank of the party, the most conservative candidates, are likely to pick up around 5 House seats and a couple of Senate seats as well. This, of course, wasn't a universal trend. There were some races where kind of a more moderate challenger defeated a more far right incumbent or a more moderate incumbent defeated a challenger. One prominent example is what happened in North Idaho with Senator Scott Herndon losing in a rematch against candidate Jim Woodward. But I think in general, the right flank of the party picked up seats, and also a lot of these candidates that one were endorsed by groups like the Idaho Freedom PAC, which is a political action committee associated with the Idaho Freedom Foundation, which has a index by which they rate lawmakers based on their kind of conservative bona fides. They really want to reduce government spending, institute school choice or school voucher type programs, issues like that. And a lot of those candidates did really well and had the support of that political action committee. And so I think it kind of was a example of the influence, again, that we've seen for years now, and influence and power of the Idaho Freedom Foundation and in the Idaho legislature.
Melissa, you were looking at one of the biggest shakeups over in Magic Valley election night. What happened? What did we see?
In Magic Valley, we saw three incumbents lose between districts, legislative districts 24 and 25. So 24 is Camas County, Gooden County, and rural Twin Falls County, and 25 is Twin Falls, the city proper. We saw Senator Linda Hartgen lose her seat to a very young challenger. He has no political experience before this. He is aligned, as were the rest of the candidates who were successful in those districts, with what's called the Magic Valley Liberty Alliance. And to what Ian said about the power of the Freedom Foundation, I don't know if it's the Freedom Foundation anymore so much as some of these other groups that are popping up that certainly are very conservative, but they're not the only, the Freedom Foundation isn't the only driving force at this point anymore. With the Magic Valley Liberty Alliance, they had their entire slate of candidates in those two districts. All of them were successful. And they ousted longtime Twin Falls City Council member, Representative Greg Lanting, Chanel Dixon, Representative Chanel Dixon, who's a longtime local GOP mover and shaker, who all of them had endorsements from longtime Magic Valley lawmakers who used to be really big driving forces in the local party. That's not the case anymore. The tides have really shifted in that area. I think a couple years ago when Senator Glenita Zeiderfeld won her race against longtime incumbent Jim Patrick, a lot of people thought that was maybe an anomaly. I think it was kind of a signal that the tides were changing. And we saw that play out on Tuesday night, I think. Elsewhere in the state, we at Idaho Reports, we really focused on races outside of the Treasure Valley. And, you know, Ian's right pointing out, you know, in North Idaho, Senator Scott Herndon lost to former Senator Jim Woodward. But in District 8, which is kind of rural central Idaho down to Elmore County, their entire slate of incumbents lost, all three of them. And Kevin Richard of Idaho Education News and I were talking. I can't remember the last time all three incumbents in a district lost their primary. Mm. That's pretty remarkable. And they all lost to challengers who were more conservative and who attacked their voting record as being not conservative enough. That does change the face of the legislature, and it changes the conversation around some of the proposals that haven't gained as much traction in recent years, like school choice. And that's something that I'm going to be keeping an eye on in this upcoming session.
Well, I was going to
ask- Melissa, that's a great, thanks for raising that there are lots of other influential groups here too. I think you're totally right that it's not just the Freedom Foundation influencing elections. Another example locally was the leader of the Senate, Chuck Winder, in his race. There was a lot of money spent against him by a out-of-state libertarian student group called Young Americans for Liberty, spending ads targeting his campaign. And in a major upset, perhaps the biggest upset of the primary, he lost to his challenger, Josh Kaiser, who doesn't have political experience before. And this is, Winder was an 8-term lawmaker. So there's definitely a lot of different groups trying to influence these elections when they come.
And Melissa, you mentioned school choice. I know you've mentioned Idaho Launch. I mean, you can't tell what new lawmakers are going to do, especially the first time in the Idaho legislature. But we're talking about some either champions of some things or folks who were opposed, and they're gone. And so new people are coming in, and that could change the direction of things like school choice and Idaho Launch.
We talk a lot about this on this week's Idaho Reports. It's airing tonight at 8 p.m. on Idaho Public Television. It was not a good night for launch proponents. It was a very good night for school choice proponents. We discussed this week whether the future of launch, the very existence of launch, is in jeopardy. I'm not sure that lawmakers are going to repeal the program, especially with how popular it is among high school seniors. And just as a reminder for folks who aren't familiar with launch, it's a program that provides $8,000 in scholarships to graduating high school seniors who are pursuing in-demand careers, so that money can be used for education or training. And it is very popular among high school seniors, and it's not very popular among some in the Republican caucus. It barely passed in 2023, the creation of the program itself. I think that lawmakers are going to take a hard look at the program, and we might see some reforms. But we have extended conversations about that tonight on Idaho Reports. But I think whatever happens, it is going to be a huge shift in education conversations moving forward. Another incumbent who lost was House Education Chairman Julie Yamamoto out of Canyon County. So we know that the House Education Committee is going to look very different next year.
And so, I mean, school launch might get more traction in the next legislative session.
School choice, right?
Yeah, school choice, sorry.
I imagine that's a very real possibility. House Speaker Mike Moyle, who survived his primary, assuming that he is still Speaker next year because leadership races are in the fall, he doesn't have as much of a check in the Senate with, you know, depending on how those leadership races in the Senate shake out. He's not going to have quite as much of a check on some of the proposals that he wants. He's a huge school choice fan. And so depending on who he puts in to the House Education Committee spot and who the Senate picks as their new leadership team, that conversation about school choice, I think, just changed in a huge way.
Wow. Okay, so I want to get your biggest takeaways from the primary this year. Christina, let's start with you. What are you seeing overall? What struck you?
I think, as Ian and Melissa have talked about here, when it comes to the campaign finance money, it's a big deal. But for me, I just keep coming back to this turnout idea. And, you know, you're talking about the primary here, but the caucus turnout was abysmal. You know, I'm very interested to see how the Open Primaries Initiative might affect some of these vote totals and voter participation. You know, that it's still going through the process to qualify for the November ballot. County clerks are right now going through and verifying these signatures, and we expect them to finish that work by late June or early July. And then, of course, they have to be submitted to the Secretary of State's office for another round of verification. But I think that, you know, these caucus turnout numbers really shows that people are coming to see voter participation is just not where it should or could be. And I think if the Open Primaries Initiative, if it passes, could lead to more voter participation in the future. And it's something that we'll certainly be watching and reporting on. And, you know, it comes when if the GOP's primary election is opened, you know, it would affect things like school choice ideas and things like that within the party. And so I think the thing for me is just how few people actually did get to participate in the presidential caucuses and the primary.
Ian, what about you? What's your biggest takeaway? Because, I mean, primary and caucus this week.
Yeah, so I think with the primary, I think my biggest takeaway is that, you know, as I said, there was a lot of speculation about what kinds of choices the Republican Party voters would make this year. Would the right flank of the party continue its gains in the legislature, or would partisan voters choose to select more moderate candidates? And I think while what happened with the Senate race in North Idaho that we mentioned is a significant change there, I think that ended up being more of an outlier than a trend. And the right flank of the party really flexed its muscles this election cycle. As Melissa talked about, that could have a lot of policy implications next legislative session, like with school choice, the governor's education programs, more scrutiny on agency budget bills, perhaps more bills on social issues like gender-affirming care or or related to diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives at universities, things like that. I think we could see more legislation on those topics next year. So that'll be something to watch out for.
Melissa, what's your biggest takeaway from this week?
I think that negative campaigning backfired in a big way, regardless of where it was coming from. We saw the Idaho Liberty PAC, which is aligned with some of the more moderate Republicans in the state and some very powerful moderate Republicans in the state. They went after four conservative incumbent senators and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in negative ads against them. Some of them were kind of stretching the truth a little bit. And they were only successful in ousting one of those incumbents, Senator Chris Traikel out of Caldwell. The other three, Senators Brian Lenny, Tammy Nichols, and Glenita Zeiderfeld, they all won pretty comfortably. We saw negative campaigning against Speaker Mike Moyle from the right, from the Young Americans for Liberty. We saw that backfire in a big way. We saw negative campaigning against Representative Lori McCann and Wendy Horman and so many others backfire. I think, you know, again, we talk about this at length on Idaho Reports this week. I don't think that messaging resonated with Idaho primary voters. You know, one note on what Christina was saying, not at all to disagree that voter turnout is so important. 24% is actually kind of in line with primary voter turnout in past Idaho elections. If anything, it's up a little bit. And so not to say that we wouldn't want to see those numbers be higher as people who are very interested in civics and education and government involvement. I do think that's kind of par for course. And I think that the growth in the state also really changes that conversation about who's turning out and why. We have a lot of new voters in the state who have just moved here in the last 4 years. And frankly, some of them just got elected or just got nominated as their party's nominee. A couple of the Magic Valley successful candidates were brand new to the state, you know, in the last 4 years, one of them. And so I think that the conversation about turnout and about voter engagement specifically is going to change in ways that might not even have anything to do with the open primary initiative should it get on the ballot. But regardless, I do think that the negative campaigning really didn't resonate at all with Idaho voters. And we saw that regardless of where it was coming from.
Fascinating. Okay. Continuing our reporter roundtable now with our own Rachel Cohen. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Sam.
You have an update on the continuing saga of the Sawtooth Trail dispute. Set the stage for folks who don't know the background on this story.
Yeah, so this is a trail that connects the city of Stanley to Redfish Lake. These are, of course, two of the more popular areas in the Sawtooth National Recreation Area. And the goal of the Forest Service was to, one, increase just overall public access and trail access in that area, and also to connect these two popular places that you would otherwise need to go on the busy highway to get to and from. And the legal dispute over this trail dates back to 2019, when the ranch owners David Bourne and Lynn Arnaud filed a lawsuit against the Forest Service because this trail is a public trail, but it crosses their private property. And the U.S. Forest Service has a conservation easement that dates back to 2005 on the property. And as the government was getting closer to actually constructing the trail around 2019, that's when the ranch owners filed the lawsuit to stop it. They wanted it in a different place, and they argued that it violated some federal environmental laws. There are some wetlands on the property. But really at the heart of the dispute is what that easement says and what the Forest Service is allowed to do under it. And the property owners argue that there was already a path on the property that they thought was what would be maintained for public use, but the Forest Service said, no, the plan all along was to create a real trail for the public to use. In 2022, a district court judge ruled in favor of the Forest Service. They appealed. Again, last fall, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judges ruled in favor of the Forest Service. So now the property owners are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to take a look at this case.
Well, you mentioned back to 2019, because I remember Idaho Matters. We talked to David Boren, that's the landowner in the case, back then. And 5 years later, here we are, or trying to be, at the U.S. Supreme Court. You wrote that three groups have filed briefs with the court, friendly briefs, to the landowner. Who are they?
Yeah, the groups that filed briefs in this case, they're urging the Supreme Court to review it, because if they don't, the case is essentially dead. And the groups that filed the briefs, they all advocate for private property rights. A couple of them are based in Sacramento, and they, you know, one of the nonprofits has been involved in a lot of high profile legal cases surrounding private property rights. And then the other group is made up of local landowners, landowners in the Sawtooth National Recreation Area. And again, that means that they own private property in this federally protected area. And like the ranch owners at the center of this case, they also have conservation easements on their property. And that group took issue with how the federal appeals court ruled, particularly when it comes to the statute of limitations. And the judges essentially said that when Boren and Arnone filed their lawsuit in 2019, it was too late. That's because there's a federal law called the Quiet Title Act that says property disputes with the federal government have a 12-year statute of limitations, and the conservation easement was signed in 2005, so that would have made their lawsuit 2 years late. And the property owners say that if they also have disagreements with the Forest Service about what they think their easement on the property says, they want to have a right to challenge that. And they don't think that the statute of limitations, how the court was applying it, should get in their way.
And this is, you know, about timing, at least at this point. You mentioned the statute of limitations, but I think if I read it right, the argument is about when the Forest Service's final plans are submitted versus when early plans are submitted. Is that fair? Is that what Boren is arguing?
Yeah, and the timing is kind of central to this case, because the statute of limitations is sort of gatekeeping arguments about the easement itself and what it says. And so when the court says that the lawsuit came too late, you know, they're not really letting the challenges or disagreements to the easement be heard. And that's sort of what the property owners take issue with. So in terms of when that statute of limitations starts, that is a central question in this case, because it determines whether that kind of gatekeeping to the easement dispute can stand. And the government says that the easement was signed in 2005, and therefore the property owners knew or should have known what the plans were back then. But the ranch owners say, well, we didn't really know what you were going to do here until you published the plans for what the trail would look like, and that was in 2014.
Gotcha. Now, I thought this was interesting. You said the Forest Service has spent $48 million buying easements since 1974 on 104 parcels. And is this sort of how the service works when the land is maybe under some kind of protection?
Yeah, so conservation easements are pretty common in the Sawtooth National Recreation Area. And some historians or people familiar with the founding of this area in 1972 say that conservation easements are in many ways the backbone of protection, because this is not a national park. There's still a lot of private property in this federally protected area, and high in the mountains there are some areas that are protected under the wilderness designation. But on the valley floor, conservation easements were really the strategy the government used to protect the landscape, and it allowed them to keep the land, much of the land, in private ownership, which is what Idahoans wanted at the time. But they also didn't want the Sawtooths to become Sun Valley or Jackson Hole with a lot of development. And so that was kind of how the strategy for balancing that private property, but also limiting development in this area.
So what's next? Are we waiting on the Supreme Court now?
Yes, we are waiting on the Supreme Court. Four justices have to vote to take this court up for it to be heard. The Supreme Court gets lots of requests, thousands of requests a year to take a look at cases, and they take, you know, maybe a couple hundred. And so, you know, it's kind of unknown as to whether they will take this up. However, there have been some other recent cases that the Supreme Court has issued rulings on related to private property rights and even this Quiet Title Act, the statute of limitations. And so it's possible that they will find that they have more work to do in figuring out the legal questions surrounding specifically that topic.
But the trail is open now. I remember back in 2019, they were still just starting to build the big trail, but it's open now, right?
It is open now. It officially opened to the public last summer, and it's like a 4.5 mile, I think, graded trail. I don't know if graded is the right word, but it's like gravel coated, and it is non-motorized in the summer, and it's also wheelchair accessible too.
Wow. Well, Rachel, I know you'll stay on it. Thank you for giving us an update.
Thanks, Sam.
And I want to thank everyone who took part in today's Reporter Roundtable. Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun. Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, along with our own James Dawson. And Rachel Cohen with Boise State Public Radio News.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.